In a video on Lenin prior to the Russian Revolution, we discussed the psychological reasons for why Lenin became a socialist. And an interesting thing about this is that when we look at all the other major socialists, a very concerning pattern emerges. What is that pattern? Let's find out. First, we'll outline the concept as it applies to Lenin, and then see if the others fit the bill as well. So, starting in Lenin's childhood, Lenin was brought up in a Lutheran Christian family, which instilled in him a belief in altruism. Altruism isn't just helping others, altruism is the idea of placing everyone else before yourself, of destroying the self in order to serve the needs of others, of devoting oneself to society. It is fundamentally an idea of self-sacrifice. It's not enough to just serve others, but you must ask nothing in return. You're only seen as good if you've given everything and asked for nothing. Any action that an altruist takes that serves himself is seen as bad, since only others may receive the benefits of your actions. As you can imagine, this doctrine is dangerous, as you're little more than a sacrificial animal. The victim has guilt and shame instilled straight into his psyche. He thinks himself lesser than everyone else, and his duty is to selflessly serve others, not himself, like a slave or a serf. Well, what's implicit within the doctrine of altruism is the belief that you're a bad person. Everyone else deserves the rewards of life, but you do not. If you have material wealth, you must give it away, because you're a bad person. If you want something, you must be greedy, because you're a bad person. If you've achieved something, well, you must not take pride in that achievement, because you're a bad person if you do. And so, the victim of altruism develops a hatred of himself, a self-hatred, and a low self-esteem. But more than this, under altruism, those who have less deserve help from you, because they're better than you. This means you should give your last penny to the beggar in the street, and he's morally virtuous to take it from you. This effectively rewards victimhood, and if you reward victimhood, everyone is incentivized to become victims. I'm anxious, I'm depressed, I'm oppressed, I've got this ailment or that ailment, I identify as being a member of this marginalized group, and therefore you should give me special treatment. Everyone is trying to one-up themselves in order to be the most victimized, because they get sympathy and rewards if they do. In other words, altruism is a race to the bottom. Well, after being indoctrinated into this altruistic worldview, Lenin witnessed his father, brother, and sister die, and Lenin and the rest of the family were then ostracized from society. Now, in that video, I concluded that because he had lost his father, who was a bourgeois nobleman, and had a revolutionary brother, that there must have been an antagonism towards the father. That is probably still true, but whilst working on this video and contrasting Lenin with the other socialists, I've realized that it's not so much daddy issues, as many of the comments describe it as, but rather parent issues. In each case, including Lenin, there were major problems at home, although the exact details vary from case to case. Either the father died early, or was abusive, or was otherwise absent from their lives, leaving them with strong mothers or other guardians who were usually religious and highly influential in their upbringing. For Lenin, the main bond he had was with his saint-like mother, as he described her, and his sisters, with whom he had a strong connection too. Lenin didn't have many male friends, and was more interested in women, which is also something we'll see with the other socialists. In addition to guilt and shame, Lenin's hatred of himself manifested as a hatred of the world around him. It would be wrong for the altruist to want material things, as those things are only for other people. Therefore, the materialist world is seen as bad. This does two things. First, the altruist doesn't have a drive for work, since earning wealth and possessing things are both bad, and this could be a subconscious excuse to be lazy. And secondly, because he sees himself as bad, the altruist doesn't feel himself capable of being able to make it in the world. He therefore develops a fear of independence, which is why Lenin only worked one job for 2 years prior to the revolution in 1917. He spent the other years scrounging off his mother and others. This clash between his altruist morality and objective reality leads to an anger against the world. Lenin's inability to become independent or take responsibility for himself also resulted in a desire to be taken care of. This is why he wants to be close to his mother and sisters, and why he desired power via revolution. It was a means to not only destroy the reality he didn't like and get revenge on the oppressors who had wronged him supposedly, but also to enable him to be taken care of and avoid real work. The point is that socialism is not about helping others. It's a desire to be taken care of, coming from a fear of independence rooted in an altruistic hatred of the self due to a problematic upbringing. And this is where the socialist ideology and philosophy comes in. If only we could transcend the material world and not have to work. Well, we can, apparently. Marx's doctrine of dialectical materialism says we can transcend the material world and get to Plato's and Hegel's God, the Demiurgos. Now, Marx differed from Plato and Hegel, but the principles are the same. The material world is bad and we must overcome it. And if capitalism represents the material world, which is why Marx referred to it as nature, it's no wonder why Lenin now despised the capitalist system. The thing he wants to rebel against. So, to summarise the principle before going forward, altruism is given to these children by their religious parents, and while the faith is lost, the altruist morality remains, and this leads to self-hatred. Coupled with a poor relationship with one or more of their parents, and a formal school education, the child develops a fear of independence, causing laziness, which manifests as a hatred of reality and capitalism. Such a youth is then susceptible to socialist and or Marxist teachings, which, although I haven't got time to explain this in detail today, is ultimately an Orphic, Hermetic, Hegelian rejection of reality, a subconscious rebellion against the parents, an excuse to not work or earn an income, and fulfills their desire to be taken care of. Once you see it from this perspective, it all lines up. Lenin fits this bill exactly, and so do many of the others, like Trotsky. Trotsky's father was a highly successful Jewish farmer, and the family became the richest Jews in the neighbourhood. The Jewish faith and upbringing gave Trotsky an altruistic morality, even if his parents only had a casual attitude to the faith. Nonetheless, there were parental issues. David was gruff, and Etta was demanding. They expected a lot of their sons and daughters, and were angry when expectations were not fulfilled. And Lieber, Trotsky, usually earned their praise. But his memories of times when he was scolded remained with him. Trotsky was plagued by blackouts, which affected him from childhood all the way through his life. This was a condition inherited from his mother, and led to some embarrassing moments, perhaps even self-shame and low self-esteem. At first it was his mother whom he didn't like so much, until his father had an argument with a peasant over a stray cow. Trotsky was so upset that he ran into his room and cried. His mother then had to console him, but more incidents like this occurred, such as the whipping of a shepherd and a mob attacking a woman for having an affair, all of which cemented the idea in Trotsky that the villagers could not be left to enact their own justice. The government had to intervene in rural life to bring order to the area. Trotsky's father had grown up illiterate, but wanted to ensure that his children got a good education. Trotsky was therefore sent to a Christian school, which was attached to a Lutheran church, two in a row. He was an outsider who had to learn to speak Russian, and was even spat on because he didn't know the dress code, which couldn't have been good for his self-esteem. However, the family he stayed with brought him up to speed, and he became a bookworm and agnostic while at school, showing that he had lost his faith early on. And it was at age 16 that he found friends who were in the revolutionary movement, although he didn't become a Marxist just yet. Trotsky then started having arguments with his father over which career path he should take, with his father wanting him to become an engineer, reality, while Trotsky wanted to do maths at university. David saw no future in the subject and wanted his boy to opt for a more practical line of training. Their disputes were noisy and bitter, and the elder daughter, Elisheva, was upset whenever they took place in her hearing. Worse was the possibility that young Lieber, Trotsky, might choose neither option and devote his life to the revolutionary cause. Now, there were legitimate reasons to be upset with the Tsars and the way that Russia was backwards compared to the West at the time. However, in this case, it's clear that Trotsky's Jewish ethnicity played a factor, as the Jews were basically ostracized from mainstream Russian society. We'll come back to discuss this shortly. Trotsky was therefore already inclined to be rebellious, which is why he fell in with a Czech friend called Franz Chekhovsky, who was a revolutionary. Trotsky was a person who made up his mind for himself and treated his parents as a financial resource for achieving his purposes. David visited Lieber frequently, seeking to steer him away from what he thought to be a dangerous path. His father was middle class and propertied. Shevgovsky and his young friends lacked much money but were educated and restless, and Lieber felt an affinity with them. Lieber had no compunction about living at his father's expense while despising his hopes and values. The son, furthermore, was as stubborn as his father. He would no longer be told what to do, and rather than submit to the parental will, he fled his comfortable apartment and took up residence in Shevgovsky's house. Trotsky's sister also became a revolutionary, which made David, his father, realize that government school had exposed his children to dangerous ideas that he hadn't even known had existed before. Trotsky changed his name from Lieber to Lever in order to sound more Russian, and continued his studies. And though he resisted Marxism for a little longer, he eventually fell into it. His group was then apprehended by the police, and Trotsky ended up in prison, from which, you know, after this point, he had no reason to earn a wage. His bed and board was all taken care of by the state. His mother actually came to visit him and tried to get him to give up his revolutionary ways, asking, what was he going to live on? His answer was scarcely a consoling one. Good people would help him out. She retorted, and does this mean that you expect to live on alms? A blazing dispute broke out between them. It ended with him telling his mother that he no longer wanted any help from either of his parents. He was then sent to exile in Siberia, where he did work for a month and a half as an accountant for a millionaire merchant, but he was sacked for not keeping the books correctly. After all, a merchant was a member of the bourgeoisie, and they were the enemies of socialism, right? So he started writing, went into journalism, and then eventually got deeply involved into politics. The overall story, though, is that his religious upbringing embedded an altruistic morality into his psyche, which, along with his ethnicity, which we'll talk about shortly, led to self-hatred. A poor relationship with the parents, plus his formal school education, resulted in a fear of independence, made him lazy, and manifested as a hatred of capitalism. This left him susceptible to socialist and Marxist teachings, but what's interesting about this was the shame he felt towards his upbringing.
As a Marxist, he was embarrassed by the wealth of his parents, and he never properly acknowledged their extraordinary qualities and achievements. What is more, the published account of his boyhood in his autobiography tended to drop these passages where he appeared timid or pampered, and without denying his Jewish origin, he trimmed back the references to it.
This is where we have to talk about the concept of former Jews or ethnic Jews being ashamed of their Jewish heritage. Historically, the Jews were ostracized from Christian society due to religious and ethnic reasons, meaning that they couldn't own land in Christian Europe. They were, therefore, forced to live in towns and cities, and in English, towns and cities were called boroughs, which is where we get the word bourgeoisie from the French for townfolk. Unable to get a job in a predominantly Christian and agrarian society, they turned to usury, which is the lending of money and charging interest. Well, usury was banned by the Christian Pope in the Dark Ages. Thus, due to old-fashioned anti-Semitism, the only people who could be the bourgeoisie, or the money changers as Karl Marx called them, were the Jews. Many believed that the Jews were the bourgeoisie, and that capitalism came from the Jews. That's why the propaganda of anti-Semitism and anti-capitalism look exactly the same, because they are the same. Anti-Semitism and anti-capitalism are two sides of the same coin. Well, many Jews who lost their faith, or people whose fathers or grandfathers were Jews, developed a shame or self-hatred for their Jewish and or capitalist heritage. Trotsky certainly felt that way, as did many of the people in this video, since most were former Jews or related to Jews. Lenin's grandfather had been a Jewish merchant, although he didn't realise this in his youth, so it's not really a factor with him. However, even if they weren't Jewish in ethnicity, they mostly came from well-off parents, or had a schooling which put them in the bourgeois school system, resulting in a shame related to their superiority over the working people. And all the people in today's video try to do better than their parents while rebelling against them and avoiding work. And this is especially so with the next person on our list. The originator of Marxism, Karl Marx, came from a religious background. His grandfather on his mother's side had been the rabbi of the city of Nijmegen, and an ancestor on his father's side had been a rabbi of Trier in the 1700s, with other family members being rabbis too. But his father had converted to Lutheran Christianity prior to Karl Marx's birth, and Karl Marx himself was baptized by the Lutheran Church. And that's three in a row now for the Lutherans. His father wasn't really religious, but was interested in Immanuel Kant, whose philosophy tried to save faith from science. Kant's ideology is altruist to the bone, and directly led to Hegel, whom Marx read during his education. So the influence was there right from the beginning. Marx himself never practiced Judaism, and in fact, he was very anti-Semitic, criticising the Jewish obsession with money in his works like On the Jewish Question. Again, just like with Trotsky, Marx had a shame or self-hatred for his Jewish heritage. In fact, during Karl Marx's time, the German word Judentum was commonly used as a synonym for commerce, again showing the connection between capitalism and Jewishness. This shame resulted in self-hatred, which in turn led to a fear of independence, something we see in spades with Karl Marx. Marx's early life isn't known in detail, but there are snippets. He was privately educated until he entered high school, where the teachers were mostly liberals. The school was raided in 1832 by the police, who found revolutionary literature. They ended up charging two teachers for atheism and materialism. Marx then went to university, where he drank and smoked, despite the fact he had a bad chest, and unfortunately a pistol duel with a trained soldier only ended with a wound above his left eye. Had the soldier been more accurate, one of the greatest monsters in human history would have been removed before he had a chance to do any damage. But Marx lived, and joined the Young Hegelians, a discussion group that debated Hegel's ideas. Marx devoured Hegel's works, and paid tribute to Hegel for bringing him into adulthood. He basically took Hegel's dialectics and changed it to suit his own needs, which was the basis for Marxism as it came to be known. But this is a topic for another day. Marx then styled himself as a man of destiny, one of Hegel's heroes, similar to the way that Lenin thought of himself. Marx's father was disappointed that Marx had wasted his time on philosophy instead of concentrating on getting a law degree and a job. He therefore hurled grievances at his son, not only for failing his parents, but also for failing his wife-to-be, Jenny, whom Marx had fallen for.
Karl scarcely ever replied to his parents' letters. He never inquired after their health. He had spent almost 700 thalers of their money in 1 year, whereas the richest spend less than 500. He had weakened his mind and body, chasing abstractions and giving birth to monsters. He never returned home during university holidays, and ignored the existence of his brothers and sisters. The truth was that Marx had left his family behind.
This is evidence that he was ashamed of his origins and heritage, but also an indication of a poor upbringing and a bad relationship with his parents and siblings. We don't have direct evidence of that bad early upbringing, but it's clear that this must have been the case, otherwise why would he abandon his family like that? Marx's father died when Marx was 20 years old, and while some say that he had a close relationship with his father, and that the loss definitely affected him, in reality that wasn't true. Marx didn't attend the funeral, saying that the journey from Berlin would be too long, and that he had more important things to do, such as skipping class and getting into ever-increasing amounts of debt. He spent his days reading, writing and smoking, showing us that the rebellion against the father had resulted in a laziness and a fear of taking responsibility, as well as building an independent life of his own. He may have flown the nest, but as we'll see, he didn't become independent. Marx also lost a brother at this time too, so there was a broken home of sorts, although it was more that Marx had just abandoned his family. Marx fell out with his tutor, and so sent his dissertation to the University of Vienna, which had a reputation of awarding degrees without debate or delay. 9 days later, he was awarded a PhD, which was for an essay on two ancient Greek philosophers, Democritus and Epicurus. Democritus reasoned that tiny particles made up the world, atoms, which he said were uncuttable, whoops, while Epicurus said that everything in the world is just mechanical. And because this is a mechanical, materialistic world, his ethics said that we should withdraw from it, give up, and retire from life in order to not be hurt. Epicurus himself built a sheltered garden, in which he retired, ate a simple diet, spoke with a few chosen friends, and let the world outside the garden go to hell. In essence, he built a Garden of Eden. He thought that the greatest happiness is the absence of strong emotions and not taking action, meaning that happiness was a negative emotion for Epicurus. It is the state of not being hurt. And now it makes sense why Karl Marx did the exact same thing. Marx was mimicking Epicurus by becoming a scrounging scumlord and then developing a philosophy that justified his worthless existence. But note, Karl Marx didn't get a degree in economics. He was a philosopher, not an economist. He spent his time smoking, getting drunk, laughing in church, riding into towns on the back of donkeys pretending to be Jesus, and just generally avoiding work at all costs. Just like the others, Karl Marx only had a job for a short period, and spent most of his life begging for money off his friends and family, especially his mother and Engels. His mother was disappointed that Marx, now the last surviving male in the family, couldn't help her or his four sisters. In fact, rather than help her, Marx demanded financial support off of her, which she gave until she cut him off.
"Blessed is he that hath no family," Karl Marx sighed wearily in a letter to Friedrich Engels in June 1854. He was aged 36 at the time, and had long since severed his own umbilical ties. His father was dead, and his surviving siblings had little to do with him. Relations with his mother were icy and distant, not least because she had been inconsiderate enough to stay alive and thus keep the rebellious heir from his inheritance.
Interestingly, despite later advocating in the Communist Manifesto that inheritance should be abolished, Marx had no problem accepting an inheritance of 6,000 francs from his family.
He never thought to offer the five women, his mother and sisters, any help, but rather he expected his mother to continue to support him. She was hurt and eventually cut him off almost entirely, an offence for which he never forgave her.
After 1850, Engels got an office job at his family's enterprise in Manchester. He got enough money to support himself and help out Marx, which he would do until the revolution came. He thought the revolution was just around the corner, and then spent the next 20 years working at the office, repeatedly predicting the revolution that never came, while sending Marx money.
Throughout his life, Marx appealed over and again for handouts from every friend or relative he could think of, even eventually from one of his grown children. Wow, what a pathetic loser! As Engels' fortune grew, so did his generosity, but Marx always adjusted his standard of living to a level above what he received. Thus, he was never out of debt, and he never stopped asking Engels for more. Engels served Marx as a kind of substitute mother, sending him pocket money, fussing over his health, and continually reminding him not to neglect his studies.
We can certainly see the lack of independence here and the desire to be taken care of by a mother-like figure. At one point, Marx told Engels that the book he was working on, Das Kapital Volume 1, would be compiled in about 5 weeks. Instead, it took another 15 years to write what can only be described as a long, inaccessible, confusing, and totally nonsense book. Nonetheless, Engels was loyal to the end, financially supporting Marx for another 16 years, waiting patiently for the next volume, only for Marx to die before it was completed. Marx never tried to get a job, and was happy to allow his wife and family to suffer as he begged and borrowed to keep them. He had massive arguments with his wife over this, and she reminded him that women in the 1800s were entirely dependent upon their husbands due to Eve's original sin. But even she couldn't shake him from his idleness.
Dearest heart, I am greatly worried about our future. If you can, do set my mind at rest about this. There is too much talk on all sides about a steady income. A steady income was one necessity of life that always eluded Karl Marx. And as one of the biggest ironies of history, for all his mockery of bourgeois morals and manners, Marx was at heart a supremely bourgeois patriarch.
He kept a maid, even though he barely had enough money to keep her or his wife. He claimed he was devoted to the working man, but was never kind to anyone and was often cruel. He didn't get along with people, and was vicious with his rivals and supporters. At one point, Marx's procrastination resulted in him being called a reactionary by another socialist, and it was this affair that ended the Communist League.
Let me describe for you, as it really was, just one day in our lives. Since wet nurses here are exorbitantly expensive, I was determined to feed my child myself, however frightful the pain in my breast and back. But the poor little angel absorbed with my milk so many anxieties and unspoken sorrows that he was always ailing and in severe pain by day and night. In his pain he sucked so hard that I got a sore on my breast, an open sore. Often blood would spurt into his little trembling mouth. I was sitting thus one day when suddenly in came our landlady. She demanded the £5 we still owed her, and since this was not ready to hand, two bailiffs entered the house and placed under distraint what little I possessed, beds, linen, clothes, everything, even my poor infant's cradle, and the best of the toys belonging to the girls, who burst into tears. At last a friend came to our aid, we paid, and I hurriedly sold all my beds, so as to settle with the apothecaries, bakers, butchers, and milkmen who, their fears aroused by the scandal of the bailiffs, had suddenly besieged me with their bills.
Despite this, Marx not only still didn't get a job, but he got his wife pregnant again. And again. And then got his maid pregnant just to top it off, a secret that was kept from the public until 1962, although there's a chance it was actually Engels' child. When Jenny's most recent child died, they couldn't afford the cost of an undertaker, so just left the corpse in their bedroom while the family slept in another. Only when a generous neighbour lent them £2 did they finally bury the child. Shortly afterwards, a baker knocked on their door to tell them that he'd be delivering no more bread until Marx paid his outstanding bills. I could spend all day ripping on Marx, and it's incredibly enjoyable, and objectively he deserves it, so maybe I should just do an entire video on the life of Karl Marx at some point. But for today, let's conclude our assessment of this creature of the idol. Overall, it's clear that Karl Marx was brought up under a mainstream religion, instilling him with an altruistic morality. He lost the faith but kept the altruism, had a poor relationship with his parents, a rebellion against the father, and his schooling was obviously not helpful. This led to indolence, laziness, which clashed with reality and resulted in Marx having a fear of independence. Marx thought himself better than everyone else and, falling under the spell of a different altruistic religion, an Orphic Hermetic Hegelianism, this manifested as a hatred of the current system. Socialism gave Marx permission and the drive to rebel against reality, which was a subconscious rebellion against the parents. Socialism also gave him an excuse to not work or earn an income, and fulfilled his desire to be taken care of. Spouting this philosophy to the world then led to disastrous consequences for humanity as a whole. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the man who hated money and usury was also the same man who was too lazy to earn money and was constantly in debt. Marx hated reality because it required that he stop being a good-for-nothing scrounging scumbag who needs to get a job and take responsibility for his own life, including that of his wife's. That was way too hard for him. And so Marx became an anti-capitalist to try and hide the fact that he was an abject failure of a human being. And I think I've said enough on this idiot. So let's move on to Engels. Friedrich Engels' wealthy family owned textile mills in England, and his parents were devout Calvinists. Bearing in mind that Calvinism split from the Lutheran tradition in 1529, so I'm counting that as four in a row for Lutheranism. Engels' parents brought up their son in a strict Christian household, with only the mother permitting some humour now and then. His father was a very serious man who was troubled by his son's messiness. Altruism was, therefore, instilled within Engels from an early age. He attended secondary school, but circumstances forced him to earn money, and so he trained as an apprentice in the family firm. Clearly, there was pressure for Engels to become independent, but instead, he read the philosophy of Hegel, which was, in essence, a fundamental rejection of reality. Still, he was a slightly better human being than Karl Marx. One might also say that the two characters were thesis and antithesis incarnate. Marx wrote in a cramped scrawl with countless deletions and emendations as blotchy testimony to the effort it cost him. Engels' script was neat, businesslike, elegant. Marx was squat and swarthy, a Jew tormented by self-loathing. Engels was tall and fair, with more than a hint of Aryan swagger. Marx lived in chaos and penury. Engels was a briskly efficient worker who held down a full-time job at the family firm while maintaining a formidable output of books, letters, and journalism, and often ghostwriting articles for Marx as well. Yet, he always found the time to enjoy the comforts of high bourgeois life. Horses in his stables, plenty of wine in his cellar, and mistresses in the bedroom. During the long years when Marx was almost drowning in squalor, fending off creditors and struggling to keep his family alive, the childless Engels pursued the carefree pleasures of a prosperous bachelor. Considering that revolutionaries are usually lazy people who fail to make ends meet, Engels' mother, and especially his father, were disappointed that their son had become one. And after joining the German Communist League and waiting for Marx to write the Communist Manifesto, which almost didn't get written at all because Marx was too lazy to write it, his mother begged Engels to return. She said he shouldn't concern himself with the opinions of other people.
"You have paid more heed to other people, to strangers, and have taken no account of your mother's pleas. God alone knows what I have felt and suffered of late. I was trembling when I picked up the newspaper and saw therein that a warrant was out for my son's arrest."
Engels would much rather deal with tearing down the system than go to work. He fought in several uprisings until his family told him they were about to cut off their funding, which essentially forced Engels to work for the family firm in Manchester. He pilfered the company's cash box to support Marx, as Lord Scumbag wrote Das Kapital, but Engels was under police surveillance, and as an example of how wealthy he and his family were, Engels had several homes he could go to in order to confuse the police. Engels had joined his father's firm in 1851 and retired from it in 1864 so as to continue his writing projects. Clearly, while Engels did work, he only did so reluctantly, and then only for 14 years, because for much of his life he was receiving money from his parents. Again, it's clear that a religious and altruistic upbringing, plus problems with his parents, resulted in a fear of independence, coupled with a look into Hegelianism, which led to a hatred of the current system, a system that required working and taking responsibility. Unlike the rest, Engels did reluctantly take up real work for a short time, but for most of his life he was receiving wealth from his rich parents, much like all the other socialists on this list, except for one. The next person we're going to look at was an exception. Stalin was the only one of his siblings to survive infancy, and his family were poor. His parents had been born serfs, but his father had become a small businessman who owned a shoe workshop that employed several other people. However, the style of shoe was the old traditional style that had fallen out of fashion, and so the business declined as time went on. This resulted in Stalin's father becoming a violent alcoholic, and perhaps due to his mother flirting with other men in the village, the marriage broke up. Stalin's mother took herself and Stalin to live with a friend who was a father in the church, and both she and Stalin therefore attended church. And in 1884, Stalin was taken ill with smallpox, which left his face permanently pockmarked. Stalin obviously had family issues, and later in life he tried to encourage the view that his alcoholic father wasn't his real father. Either way, Stalin was brought up in a religiously altruistic household, and the scars on his face, plus the injury he received that affected his gait and earned him the nickname Crimped, probably knocked his confidence, leading to low self-esteem. His father then returned to help his stricken son, leading to the myth that he had kidnapped him, which he hadn't, but he did force Stalin to work in his workshop, which would be the only time in his life that Stalin worked a working class job. His mother persuaded the priest to take him under their wing, but it's clear that Stalin was rebelling against the father and thus developed a fear of independence and taking responsibility for himself. It also shows that his mother was highly influential in his life.
Her triumph over her husband in a deeply patriarchal society was supported by family friends, who took the woman's side, and by the boy himself. In the parental tug of war between becoming a priest, school, or a cobbler, so-so Stalin preferred school, and therefore his mother. Unlike Bessa, KK was always ready to do whatever it took to make sure he had clothes on his back and his bills were paid. Yoseb So-So Yerimashvili, who met the future Stalin by wrestling him on the parish school playground, recalled that his friend was devoted to only one person, his mother, and KK in return was devoted to him.
I must point out that Stalin is the first socialist in today's list who wasn't brought up as a Lutheran or Calvinist. The religion he was raised in was the Russian Eastern Orthodox Church. there's others in this list who also weren't Lutheran, and so it's obviously not the type of church that affected them, but rather that they rebelled against their religion whilst retaining the altruist morality that they had been given by the faith. It is therefore a story of a loss of faith in the mainstream religion and a conversion to a new faith, which can largely be described as Hermeticism. Marxism derives from Hegelianism, which is an offshoot of Hermeticism, which ultimately has its origins in ancient times, specifically the Orthics in Greece. And I wanted to highlight this factor because the socialists we'll be looking at next were also from other faiths, not just Lutheranism or Calvinism. So it's not one specific religion that's the problem here. When the priests took Stalin to witness a hanging in 1892, Stalin sympathised with the victims, which shows that his altruistic morality was in full swing. Just like Lenin, Stalin learnt Greek, immersing him in the ancient classics and their Platonism, an Orthic philosophy of irrationalism, altruism and collectivism. And we can confirm that Stalin did read Plato directly from the Greek, so we know he was immersed in the Orthic religion. But it was at this time that Stalin began to rebel against the priests, forming a forbidden book club. Amongst political works, one book he read was The Patricide, and it's from this that Stalin adopted the nickname Cobra, after the protagonist, who was a bandit. Of course, he then read Karl Marx and became a socialist, and then was expelled from the seminary he was in, and after working a handful of odd jobs, he was arrested for reasons that are probably related to his revolutionary activities. So apart from the fact that Stalin had come from a poor background, he still fits the pattern that we've discussed. Initially brought up under the mainstream religion, altruism was installed into him before he lost his faith. Altruism, as well as other factors, led to self-hatred, rebellion, and a fear of independence, which manifested as a hatred of capitalism. But Stalin isn't the only socialist who's a little different from the others, as we see with the next person on our list, Mussolini. Mussolini had started off as a socialist before founding fascism, itself merely a variant of socialism. In fact, Mussolini's grandfather, Luigi, had been a slothful drunk who had left Mussolini's father, Alessandro, very little. Alessandro became a blacksmith, but only reluctantly, as he was more interested in politics, becoming one of the first socialists in his region at a time when they were still known as internationalists. Mussolini's first and middle names were all famous socialists and rebels deliberately picked out by his father. And unlike most socialists, his father had read Das Kapital and could recite some of it to his children. In contrast, Mussolini's mother, Rosa, was a devout Catholic, which is why Benito was placed in a school run by monks, just like Stalin. So Mussolini was instilled with both socialism and an altruistic morality from his parents and upbringing. And he did attempt a few jobs here or there, but never stuck with them very long, instead reading the works of socialists, syndicalists, and Nietzsche. Later he read Mikhail Bakunin, a Russian revolutionary collectivist anarchist, and Zola, amongst others. Each day he wore the same clothes, black suit, broad-brimmed black hat, black cravat, black cloak. He carried a knife and a knuckle duster, concealed about his person. Later he would carry a revolver as well. Local people found him odd and scary. They called him the Man in Black. Often at night he used to stagger about town drunk. Sometimes he slept in the street outside his favourite bar. He was always in debt and frequently wrote to his friend Santa Badeschi asking for loans. He also asked many people in Gualtieri for loans. He was jailed 11 times before coming to power, sometimes for vagrancy. Others for being violent people, including women. Mussolini definitely had a strong mother, as well as women issues. He may also have informally married his half-sister, whom he may have had a child with, although there's a debate about whether she was really his half-sister or not, and whether the child was his or not. Regardless, His parents died when he was in his 20s, and like Karl Marx, Mussolini cheated on his wife and had a series of affairs, at least three, with one becoming pregnant, and one of those mistresses was Margherita Sarfatti, a Jewish woman whose father was a businessman and landowner. Again, with Mussolini, religion gave him an altruistic morality, but he lost his faith. Parental problems plus a strong female presence in his childhood led to a fear of independence, which in turn evolved into a hatred of the capitalist system reality. But unlike most of the others in today's video, Mussolini's father was already socialist and instilled socialism in him when he was young. So he's a bit of an exception here, because most of the others fell into socialism against the wishes of their parents, whereas Mussolini's father was already socialist and Mussolini just went along with it. So in this instance, it was Alessandro's relationship with his father, Luigi, that needs to be looked at, because it's the alcoholism of the grandfather that led to parental issues and a rebellious fear of independence for the father, which influenced his son. Thus, the pattern is still there, even if it's a bit different. Same with the next socialist on the list. Adolf Hitler's father, Alois, was an illegitimate child of a peasant woman who ended up climbing the social ladder to become a customs inspector. Due to his illegitimacy, it's not clear who Alois's father was, with some speculating it may have been a Jewish man, possibly even a Rothschild. The evidence points elsewhere, but his third wife, Hitler's mother Clara, was Alois's second cousin. Adolf Hitler was born into a comfortable, middle-class family which had both a cook and a maid, but his father, Alois, was strict, frugal, and had a bad temper. In other words, he was a tyrant. Clara Hitler was more loving and nurturing, leading Hitler himself to conclude, "I had honoured my father, but loved my mother." Adolf's early years were spent then under the smothering protectiveness of an over-anxious mother in a household dominated by the threatening presence of a disciplinarian father, against whose wrath the submissive Clara was hopeless to protect her offspring. "It was especially my brother, Adolf, who challenged my father to extreme harshness and who got his sound thrashing every day." Hitler himself, during his late-night fireside monologues in the 1940s, often recounted that his father had sudden bursts of temper and would immediately hit out. What the legacy of all this was for the way Adolf's character developed must remain a matter for speculation. That its impact was profound is hard to doubt. I don't like it when historians cop out like this. Not only is there a definite pattern in their upbringing, but in the case of Hitler, it plays out just like all the others. Hitler's eldest half-brother had moved out of the home due to tensions with the father, and in fact ended up in and out of prison for such charges as theft and bigamy. He then established a family in England before abandoning it, which shows that conflicts at home resulted in a rebellion from the children. For 2 years, Hitler attended classes at the Benedictine monastery at Lambach, near which his father had purchased a farm. There he sang in the choir, took singing lessons, and, according to his own account, dreamed of one day taking holy orders. This is important because Hitler not only received a Christian upbringing and wanted to become a priest at one point, but it gave him that altruistic morality that's going to clash with reality, as we're about to see. Hitler spent his youth obsessed with Wild West stories, which is where his rebellious streak started to show, something that was noticed by his teachers. He went to school for his drawing, but hated his teachers and schooling, and didn't make any close friends, nor desired any. His grades in school were awful, as Adolf didn't apply himself. He later chastised his teachers, calling them abnormal and mentally deranged for daring to give him bad marks. Again, his conflict with his parents plus the altruist morality led to a fear of independence resulting in sloth and laziness, and thus a clash with reality. Alois wanted Adolf to become a civil servant, like he had been. Hitler wanted to be an artist, which Alois didn't agree with. Alois rightly saw that Adolf's career choice was pointless, that his son was being lazy, deliberately trying to avoid work, and that this was going to lead to a purposeless existence.
Alois had worked his way up through industry, diligence, and effort from humble origins to a position of dignity and respect in the state service. His son, from a more privileged background, saw fit to do no more than dawdle away his time drawing and dreaming, would not apply himself in school, had no career path in view, and scorned the type of career which had meant everything to his father. The dispute amounted, therefore, to more than a rejection of a civil service career. It was a rejection of everything his father had stood for, and with that, a rejection of his father himself.
Adolf was also pan-German, while Alois was not, so this conflict with his father also had a political dimension too. When Adolf was 13, his father then died in January 1903, bearing in mind that Hitler had also lost a brother in 1900, so there was loss and turmoil during Hitler's childhood, along with parental issues. This obviously left him with a fear of independence, as well as a desire to be taken care of, which is shown by the fact he persuaded his mother to let him leave school at 16 after a year of illness, which was probably faked, even though he had no plan for what career he was going to go into. His mother died 2 years later, and in the 2 years before her death, Hitler did absolutely nothing of worth.
In these 2 years, Adolf lived a life of parasitic idleness, funded, provided for, looked after, and cosseted by a doting mother, with his own room in the comfortable flat in the Humboldtstrasse in Linz, which the family had moved into in June 1905. His mother, his aunt Joanna, and his little sister Paula were there to look after all his needs, to wash, clean, and cook for him. His mother even bought him a grand piano, on which he had lessons for 4 months between October 1906 and January 1907. He spent his time during the days drawing, painting, reading, or writing poetry. The evenings were for going to the theatre or opera, and the whole time he daydreamed and fantasized about his future as a great artist. The indolent lifestyle, the grandiosity of fantasy, the lack of discipline for systematic work, all features of the later Hitler, can be seen in these 2 years in Linz. What apparently made these last years of approaching manhood so happy for Hitler was the freedom from having to work, which gave him the freedom to brood, to dream, to spend his days roaming the city streets or the countryside, declaiming to his companion what was wrong with the world and how to right it.
Unfortunately, Clara was ill with breast cancer. Her doctor, who was Jewish, but whom Hitler had great respect for, said this about their relationship.
"While Hitler was not a mother's boy in the usual sense, I never witnessed a closer attachment. Their love had been mutual. Clara Hitler adored her son. She allowed him his own way whenever possible. For example, she admired his watercolor paintings and drawings and supported his artistic ambitions in opposition to his father. At what cost to her, one may guess."
Hitler was rejected for Art Academy because his art was clearly not up to scratch, despite what some of his modern adherents say. When his mother died, he claimed poverty, but actually had enough inheritance to live without working for another year, so that's exactly what he did. He was offered an apprenticeship as a baker by a guardian of the family, but he turned it down. His aunt tried to get him to join the civil service, but to no avail. Instead, he moved to Vienna, later saying in Mein Kampf that this was where his political philosophy came from. That's disputed, and we don't have time to get into that debate today, but once he was rejected from the Art Academy for the second time, his temper flared.
Hitler tried again the following year, and this time his drawings were so poor that he was not admitted to the test. For the ambitious young man, this was, as he later wrote, a bolt from the blue. He had been absolutely convinced that he would be successful. Choking with his catalogue of hates, he would pour his fury over everything, against mankind in general, who did not understand him, who did not appreciate him, and by whom he was persecuted and cheated. Rallying against the lack of understanding for true artistry at the academy, he spoke of traps laid. Kubizek claimed to remember his exact words, for the sole purpose of ruining his career. The tirades of hate directed at everything and everybody were those of an outsized ego desperately wanting acceptance and unable to come to terms with his personal insignificance, with failure and mediocrity. As he makes clear in Mein Kampf, he had the petty bourgeoisie's gnawing fear of sliding back into the ranks of the proletariat, of the manual labourers.
There's a whole discussion about what Hitler read in Vienna. A bunch of nationalist and socialist books, including books on philosophy like Nietzsche, have been proposed, but the debate isn't settled. What we do know is that he was exposed to the works of Georg Ritter von Schönener, who was an early advocate of socialism on the national level. The Heil greeting and the title of Führer come from Schönener, as did the anti-Semitism, the pro-social reform, anti-democracy and German nationalism. So I think it's clear that Hitler was brought up under a mainstream religion, instilling him with an altruist morality, but due to poor relationships with his father and teachers, he then lost his faith and started rebelling. He did keep his altruist morality, however, and this clashed with the reality of having to get a job and become independent. It was then just a short step before he fell under another altruist religion that called for constant rebellion, revolution, a subconscious rebellion against the father, so that everyone in Germany could be taken care of, including himself, which was his desire as shown by his upbringing. While slightly different from some of the others, the pattern clearly applies to Hitler as it does for Mao. Mao Zedong's father had started off impoverished, but had become one of the wealthiest farmers in his village. He would beat Mao and his siblings, while his Buddhist mother would try to lessen his father's temper.
The family conflicts, the cruelty of his father, and the defenselessness of his mother, whom he greatly loved and pitied, inevitably affected the character of Mao. He grew into a passionate and proud rebel, no less stubborn than his father, whom he greatly resembled. Although irritated by his father's stern temper, Mao himself became increasingly harsh, bitter, and headstrong.
Mao started off Buddhist before abandoning the faith in his mid-teens, but he learnt about Confucianism and could quote some of the text by heart. He fell out with his teacher, who was equally as harsh as his father, but instead of taking up a job in the family firm, Mao decided to continue his studies, which he had to do secretly at night to prevent his father from seeing him.
Already in early childhood, under the influence of his despotic father, incendiary literature and his surroundings, he concluded that open rebellion was the only way to defend one's rights. If you remained humble and obedient, you would be beaten over and over again.
After an arranged marriage which he didn't want, Mao ran away from home and lived in the house of an unemployed student. He only returned once his bride died of dysentery, at which point he asked his father for money to continue his studies. He wasn't sure what to do with himself, swapping from one school to another, until realizing that teachers and schools were failing him, at which point he decided he would just study on his own. He therefore read books from Western authors, including neo-Kantian philosopher Friedrich Paulson, instilling him with an altruist morality system. All the while, he was asking his father for money, which he got until he eventually cut him off.
Why did Mao prefer to lean on his father rather than get a job? In a big city like Changsha, there were many opportunities for work, even though many of these jobs were menial. Mao, however, didn't even consider such possibilities. As a student, a potential member of the gentry, an intellectual, he felt he belonged to a higher class than these soldiers, peasants and coolies. Not only Mao, but other young Chinese intellectuals from commoner backgrounds, who had only a primary education, felt they were special in a society where virtually everyone was illiterate. "I began life as a student, and at school acquired the ways of a student. I then used to feel it undignified to do even a little manual labour, such as carrying my own luggage in the presence of my fellow students, who were incapable of carrying anything, either on their shoulders or in their hands. At that time, I felt that intellectuals were the only clean people in the world, while in comparison, workers and peasants were dirty. I did not mind wearing the clothes of other intellectuals, believing them clean. But I would not put on clothes belonging to a worker or peasant, believing them dirty."
Mao would briefly work as a librarian's assistant while at university before entering politics. So again, Mao was brought up Buddhist, abandoned the faith, but retained the altruistic morality it had instilled within him, and he was in a reasonably well-to-do family plagued by parental issues, and all of this led to a fear of independence which clashed with reality and evolved into a hatred of the capitalist system. And although he hadn't started off as a Christian, we can see how Mao fits in with the rest of the list, including the next and final one that we'll discuss today. Pol Pot's family were well off compared to their neighbours, having 50 acres of rice paddy, which was 10 times the average. Pot's father would hire the other poorer neighbours as labourers at harvest time. Pol Pot was indoctrinated into Buddhism from an early age, again instilling altruism into his psyche. Like Stalin and some of the others, he was placed in a monastery, so he was separated from his parents, and because Pol Pot's family was some of the king's mistresses, Pol Pot used to visit and receive intimate favours with some of the women there. I bring this up because it shows that his parents were absent, but there were strong motherly figures in his life. Pol Pot later went to college, which he attended during the Second World War. He witnessed the political disturbance the war brought, and in its aftermath he came across the Communist Manifesto. After failing an exam, he went to Paris, becoming one of only 250 Cambodians to be sent abroad for a university education since the beginning of the 1900s. In the words of historian Philip Short, Pol Pot had become part of a minuscule elite. Again, there was no need to find a job and make his own way in the world, and that fear of being an independent person was there. At this point, Pol Pot only wanted Cambodian independence from the French. However, because China had become communist, and because Stalin had just recognised Ho Chi Minh's government in Vietnam, by 1951 the ideas of independence and communism were merging in his mind. A Marxist circle was formed in Paris, which was a secret organisation to discuss events and study Marxist texts. These included the works of Marx himself, Lenin, Mao and others. Eventually, the group ended up becoming Stalinist, which was unfortunate for the Cambodian people, as Pol Pot then became committed to revolution. So again, a prosperous and religious upbringing, an altruistic morality, plus parental issues, in this case absence, led to a fear of independence, which in turn evolved into a hatred of the capitalist system, reality. To be fair, though, while I have read some books about what the Khmer Rouge did to Cambodia, this is the first time I've actually looked at Pol Pot's upbringing, and I've only used one book for that. So there could be more to his upbringing than what I've described here today. Pol Pot was a bit of a last minute addition. But even with the limited amount of information here, the pattern we've been discussing does fit Pol Pot like it does the others. And this cannot be a coincidence. All of them came from highly religious backgrounds which instilled an altruist morality in them. They then lost or rebelled against the mainstream religions, but retained their altruism. Most had rich parents, and some came from poverty, but regardless, none of them were required to work in their early lives, if ever. And even in the few occasions where they did work a job, it was only for brief periods, and usually they didn't want to do the work, didn't enjoy the work, and didn't excel at it. Sometimes they were forced to do the work by their parents or circumstances, rather than wanting to do the work for payment or to enhance their selves. They all saw profit as bad, which is simply not true, and thought themselves better than other people, which is why they thought work was beneath them. They all had a fear of independence that manifested as a hatred of the capitalist system, and they dreamed of revolution in order to bring down the material reality that demanded that they get a job. But what is crucial here is the relationship these people had to their parents. In every case, their fathers were either absent, died early, or were people that they did not get on with due to abuse or neglect. Usually their mothers were seen as saints, helping them out in their time of need, or otherwise being the loving parent versus the more aggressive father. The only exception was Pol Pot, but even in this case, his parents were out of the picture almost entirely, and this may be because of my limited evidence. But even still, other women took over the motherly role for him, and he still fought against his male teachers. So to me, this aspect is still there, even if it's not the norm. But in all these cases, their parental issues resulted in socialism and revolution, which was a subconscious rebellion against the father. And while I can't sit here and go through every single socialist who has ever lived to see if that's the case with every single one of them, I can point out that there is a lot of hate coming from the modern socialists towards what they call the patriarchy and the white cisgendered men. Are we really going to sit here and say that this is all just a coincidence? Because I think not. And I'm surprised that none of the mainstream historians that I've read have spotted this pattern before. If you do know of a book that talks about the upbringing of socialists, or their relationship with their parents, as I've discussed here, please let me know, because, well, I haven't come across such a book. And if you think about it, socialism is all about the victims, the children of history, rising up and becoming the new rulers, taking on the role of their fathers. Marx's dialectical materialism says that the universal proletariat class, with radical chains, will rise up against the capitalist class because its sufferings are universal. It's not because the proletariat are working under the capitalists, that's not the reason why. It's because they are the victims. They are victims to become the redeemed. So it's not about working hard and building up a life you can be proud of. It's not about living responsibly or being independent. Nor is it about helping others. Socialism is about avoiding all of that. It's about wallowing in victimhood and rebelling against reality as a subconscious way of rebelling against the father and avoiding work. So let's nail down this principle altogether. These children were initially brought up under the mainstream religions, instilling them with an altruist morality. And due to their poor relationships with their parents, fathers especially, and teachers, they then lost their faith and started rebelling against society and their fathers. But they kept their altruist morality, and this clashed with the reality of having to get a job and become independent. Despite thinking themselves as superior to those around them, they had a fear of becoming poor and destitute due to their indolent nature. They then all fell under the spell of another altruist religion, an Orphic Hermetic Hegelianism, that said that so-called materialist reality wasn't real, it was fake, and could be transcended via the dialectic, without having to do any real work. Socialism gave them permission and a drive to rebel against reality, which was a subconscious rebellion against the parents. It excused them for not doing any work, or earning an income, and fulfilled their desire to be taken care of. Falling under this faith then led to disastrous consequences for humanity as a whole. And I think more work would need to be done in order to confirm whether this theory is true or not for all socialists. But I do think that a pattern is certainly there, and this by itself warrants further study and analysis. I'm sure that people will be providing biographies of other socialists that they've looked into in the comments below that also align or don't align with what I've said here, so I look forward to the discussion as well as your thoughts on what I've said here. One final thing I'll say on all this is that I think this shows just how important a stable upbringing is. Having poor parenting or a broken home results in a rebellious nature and a fear of independence. What's also needed is a good philosophy that promotes self-interest, a good work ethic, and self-confidence, all of which are needed to become truly independent individuals who are capable of carving their own way in the world. The only philosophy that I know of that fits this bill is Ayn Rand's objectivism. Sadly, self-interest is seen as bad by many people for some reason, since a lot of people are altruistic due to the culture that surrounds them. I must therefore encourage you all to break the pattern so that the next generations aren't the abject failures that the current generations are. Thanks for watching. Bye for now.